Life is unpredictable. I think all of us learn that. Sometimes we learn it in good ways. Sometimes we learn it in really hard ways. You're valuable to Christianity Today, and we want you to be prepared and protected. And one of the ways that that can happen is by having a will and getting a will together for your family and to care for your loved ones. If you've already set up your will and other important estate planning documents, that's great. But if you haven't, Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to easily and affordably walk you through the whole process of creating a legally binding and state-specific will in as little as 10 minutes. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones to take this vital step, and you can get started today by visiting morect.com/will. That's more with just one O, ct.com/will. And for a limited time, you can get 10% off. That's morect.com/will.
You are listening to Quick to Listen. Each week we go beyond hashtags and hot takes and set aside time to explore the reality behind a major cultural event. Today we're talking about Black History Month, specifically Black church history here in this country. I'm Morgan Lee, an assistant editor at Christianity Today. I am joined by Mark Galley, former Christian history editor.
And I am sorry that I'm former, because it was one of the most enjoyable stints I did in my editing career, but we no longer have that magazine. And one of the most interesting subjects I studied was African-American church history.
Cool. So who is our guest today to talk about this?
To help us think a little more deeply than I can think about it is Eric Washington. He's the associate professor and a director of African and African Diaspora Studies program at Calvin College. He's been primarily interested in studying the African-American church from its development in the late 18th century through the 19th century. And more important than that, he's an avid baseball fan. And as we were noting earlier, spring training has begun, so it's a good season for baseball fans.
Always is. Hey, it's great to have you, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Happy first day of baseball for some of us. I don't know. I think opening day is probably more important.
I don't know. Seeing those guys out there stretching and taking ground balls and all that stuff.
Eric, how long have you been a fan?
Probably since I was 6 years old. So it goes back a long way.
And I got the impression you played a lot of baseball in your day, too.
Mostly in the street.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I did play organized, but my athletic career ended in ninth grade.
I see.
And what did you give it up for?
Actually, I gave it up for speech and drama.
You like performing?
I do.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining our show today. And just get into what we're talking about. I'm so glad that we have an expert here to really delve into a lot of history questions that I'm sure many of our listeners have. So February is Black History Month, and today we'd like to explore the beginnings of Black church history. Specifically, we're interested in understanding what exactly made African Americans who came to America as slaves interested in the religion of many of those who enslaved them. How did they first hear about Christianity? What type of theology appealed to them? What were the conditions and historical events that enabled it to spread? Who were the key personalities and ideas that led to the Black church becoming one of the most important institutions in America? And what type of persecution did the church face from other Christians? So from what I've read so far, it seems like some of the biggest denominations at the beginning of the 18th century that were coming over to America were the Methodist Church and the Anglican Church. And I'm wondering, Eric, if we can start here with what type of success did these denominations have when it came to sharing Christianity with African Americans in the 1700s?
The Anglican Church had a stronghold in Virginia and in the Carolinas. And in those two colonies, you had a large population of enslaved people. And actually, in the 18th century, the Anglican Church was a little cool in terms of evangelizing enslaved persons and bringing them into the church. Historians have looked at it and argued a couple of things. But primarily, what historians have argued is that Anglicanism was a little bit too stodgy in terms of its presentation, its liturgy, just too erudite for enslaved persons. That's been the major consensus among historians.
Well, I'm personally insulted by that as an Anglican. But I also think it's absolutely accurate back then and probably today as well.
Probably so, but there's hope. But that actually gets into the 19th century. But in terms of Methodism, Methodism plays a large role in the 18th century in terms of bringing enslaved persons of African descent into the church. And Methodism's emphasis on total depravity for both slaves and slave owner alike, and the universal need for human beings to be born again as a dictate of the gospel, and also that Methodist preachers tended to be less formal. They preach in open air, especially during the First Great Awakening. So they preach to, we'll say, mixed audiences, Anglos, other Europeans, Africans, Native Americans, men and women alike. And that drew enslaved persons into Methodist churches. And another fact in terms of Methodism was that there was no educational requirement to be an exhorter, as they called lay preachers. So enslaved men who had a recognized gift to preach or to exhort, they were encouraged in that. So by the time we get to the late 18th century, there were more African-American Methodists than any other Christian denomination.
That's an amazing fact that there was the freedom and willingness to preach the total depravity of both owner and slaves. Would that happen in the same setting?
Oh, yes, it would happen in the same setting. Men like George Whitefield was famous for that in his ministry here in the States.
That's very interesting, because Whitefield also is infamous for having owned slaves himself, no?
Yes, he is infamous for that. He did own slaves down in Georgia.
You guys are naming people that I know are figures in the First Great Awakening, and I'm wondering if we can just kind of talk about the effects that the Great Awakening had at large in the African-American community.
Oh, yes. This was the watershed moment for enslaved Africans and American-born people of African descent who were enslaved coming into the church. And again, most of it has to do with the type of preaching and the emphasis on the necessity of the new birth. Second half of the 18th century, once we see the Great Awakening and that those revivals moving into Virginia and the Carolinas, that's when we see enslaved persons coming into churches. So in middle of the 18th century, 1750s in Virginia, we begin to see numbers, not just African-Americans going into Methodist churches, but also Presbyterian churches as well, and Baptist churches. Same in the Carolinas, Presbyterians and Baptists and Methodists. So it was just this marked period where we see the shift from Africans and African-American enslaved persons being in churches in small numbers, relatively speaking, to really starting to flood these Protestant churches.
So these are converts from the Great Awakening revivals?
Yes, they are.
Okay. And so how are they greeted? How are they welcomed by the majority white congregations?
Well, it's mixed. In places like Virginia, where the first independent African-American churches are starting to sprout, you see people of African descent worshiping with whites. And sometimes there's relegation and segregation in churches.
What do you mean by relegation?
Relegation in the terms of African-American men, especially enslaved men, were unable to hold church office.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they could attend the church.
They could attend the church, but okay, they couldn't serve as officers. So they couldn't be an elder, couldn't be a deacon.
Okay.
This was in general. There were a few exceptions.
That just sounds like a really interesting period in the relationship between white and black Christians.
Yeah. And in some places in Virginia, you have African-American members who are starting to outnumber white members, and eventually those churches become black churches. We have examples where the white membership and the black membership part amicably. But they still part. And so you have a white church and a black church, two separate churches, but they came out of the same congregation.
Is that a split over discomfort with race as such, or was there already a style of worship among African Americans that was markedly different?
From what I've gathered in the primary sources, there's nothing about different worship styles. That doesn't mean it wasn't a concern, but it just didn't make the records. I think from my own analysis of some of those primary sources is that basically black members are outnumbering white members, and so there's a type of crisis in leadership, and black folk want they're gifted men to be leading in these churches. And so there's a compromise that comes about with the organization of separate churches.
Okay. So white congregations were uncomfortable being led by black leaders or having black elders or deacons, I assume.
For the most part, there are exceptions. There are a couple of exceptions in Virginia. Two churches that I know of, I can't remember the churches offhand, the names of them, but I remember the names of the pastors. There was one, William Lemon, who was a freed person of African descent, and he pastored a church, a Baptist church in Virginia. And there was also another pastor by the name of Josiah Bishop, who also pastored a mixed congregation.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Eric, when you've been talking, you've been mentioning the different colonies. I'm wondering, just with regards to church leadership, what was more salient, whether it was the type of denomination or which colony you were in?
Well, that's a really good question. From my reading of the history, it's really about the denomination. That's what it boils down to. And the Anglican Church, we don't see an ordained African man until the first decade of the 19th century. But we look at Baptists and also Methodists, but Baptists, you have black pastors in the 18th century, in the middle, as early as the 1750s. It's debatable that there were independent black churches at that point, but at least I would say from like the 1770s onward, you do see black men who are ordained as pastors. And this is happening in the South, not the North.
These are free black men.
Some were ordained as slaves.
Wow.
But emancipated.
After they were ordained, they were emancipated? The ordination made it possible for them to be emancipated?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. That's a different social situation than what we think of in antebellum America, for sure.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, because some of these churches, some of the older churches, older African-American Baptist churches actually were founded on plantations. So the initial membership, all of them were enslaved. And so they became independent, and you had to have a pastor. So, and the pastor was a slave too. But as I mentioned, in some of the early cases, you've had two men who received their freedom in order to pastor.
So this predates the more well-known, quote-unquote, beginning of the African-American church with the split of Richard Allen and his compatriots at Philadelphia, which happens in the 1830s, as I recall.
Well, the AME becomes incorporated at that point, but the initial split occurred in 1791.
Okay, but that's still split. This still predates that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's something I've been emphasizing in teaching, and also emphasizing in scholarship as well, that you had a number of independent African-American Baptist congregations before the Richard Allen, Absalom Jones split with the Methodists in Philadelphia.
Okay. Well, let it be known that this is the case. The beginning is much more complex and actually earlier than that. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's actually one thing that I wanted to kind of dive into a little bit. So my understanding after doing some of this, some reading all this entire month about the history of the Black Church, was that many of them were joining existing denominations. And then at some point there was a split. I'm wondering, first of all, if we can just talk about the founding of the AME Church, which I find to be a really powerful story, and then we can kind of talk about where some of these other splits came in later on.
Basically, we start with Richard Allen, but also Absalom Jones and the Free African Society. Richard Allen and Absalom Jones both were born as enslaved men. Richard Allen was able to be, he was actually born a slave in Delaware and got his freedom when he was a teenager. So we're talking like 1770s, I believe.
I heard that he actually converted his own owner.
Yes, that's according to the record. He invited, once he was converted and he was still enslaved, interesting story. Both he and his brother were converted at the same time, but they invited a fiery Methodist itinerant preacher to the farm to preach fire and brimstone to their master, to basically to shame him into emancipating them. So yeah, free. The preacher was named Freeborn Garrettson.
These names are great. Yeah.
So yeah, from there he's emancipated, and then he moves to Philadelphia, and actually he's working with Bishop Ashbury.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. He's working with Bishop Asbury. He's on the circuit. Eventually, he settles in Philadelphia, and he and other black members are part of St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church. But in 1787, Richard Allen, as well as Absalom Jones, and others, but those are the two key persons, they found the Free African Society. So that's 1787. Now, older historiography has mentioned that, oh, this is the time when we see the split. No, it's not the time we see the split. That's, again, that's the organization of the Free African Society, which was a type of mutual aid society, which wasn't so uncommon for free blacks in the North at this time. They formed these mutual aid societies basically to make sure that they could relieve the poor among them. It could be like insurance. They, it was like an insurance agency in one sense. So somebody dies and the widow doesn't have any money for burial. Well, the society will kick in. So is that type of system. But also a social support. So we have 1787 is the year of the founding of the Free African Society. And more recent work by Richard Newman called Freedom's Prophet is a biography of Richard Allen. And Newman argues that really with the founding of the Free African Society, Richard Allen, more so than Absalom Jones, had the idea of forming a separate African Methodist church. So he was already thinking about it, according to Newman. So the big split that is famous happens when 1791, where Allen, Absalom Jones, and a few other people are dragged out of St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia while they were praying.
Because allegedly they sat on the wrong pews?
Right. At that point in that church's life, they had built a gallery for the black members. Hadn't been like that before, but by that time, they had built that gallery. And this was a 5 a.m. prayer meeting. And so they were praying in an area where they wouldn't sit normally during regular worship. And so, some of the white members dragged them out of the church.
It sounds like this incident was more of a catalyst that helped push Richard Allen forward on an idea he'd had for some time.
Yes, according to Newman, and I'm pretty convinced by his argument.
So besides the founding of the AME, would you like to note some other African-American denominations that crop up before the Civil War?
Yeah, sticking with the Methodists, you have the founding of the AMEZ Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, and that occurred in New York City around the same time that Allen and Absalom Jones left St. George's, or were basically literally dragged out of St. George's. Not so dramatic, but in New York City, I think the church was the John Street Methodist Episcopal Church. Black members there were complaining of being segregated, being ostracized, being relegated. And so the leader of that movement, James Varick, he and a group of parishioners, they leave and they form the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church. And we've already talked about Baptists, but in the early part of the 19th century, we see independent Baptist churches being formed in the North, in Philadelphia and Boston and New York. First decade of the 19th century, all three of them. And they're founded basically the same way. You've had black members part of predominantly white churches, and they are experiencing racial prejudice. And they submit to the church that they have designed to form their own congregation. And the membership allows that. So you get Abyssinian Baptist Church founded during this time in New York City, African Baptist in Boston, First African Baptist in Philadelphia.
This episode is brought to you by smallgroups.com. Find everything you need to build, grow, and maintain a healthy, thriving small group ministry. Smallgroups.com equips you to develop your ministry model and train your leaders, to nurture spiritual growth in group members, to troubleshoot typical group problems, and also to avoid common pitfalls. Whatever your role in developing life-changing community, we have resources for you. Visit smallgroups.com today.
So So even these splits, except for the St. George example, sounds like they're more amicable still, the splits.
Yes. And what's interesting about this particular context is also in Philadelphia, but also in New York City, we begin to see African Presbyterian churches started. Now, in Presbyterianism, you go through that differently. And what is like in Philadelphia, this would be during the 18-teens, 1820s, there's an interest in doing mission work among free blacks. And so the presbytery there in Philadelphia basically brings in a formerly enslaved man by the name of John Gloucester. And he basically starts a church with the blessing of the presbytery. It's a mission. So we have African Presbyterian Church starting in Philadelphia. And eventually, I think at least three, maybe four more African Presbyterian congregations are going to sprout up in the Presbytery of Philadelphia. Basically, the same thing will happen in New York City during the 1820s as well. We're starting to see this, especially in the North. And let me mention the Anglican Church at this point, and this is related to Richard Allen and the founding of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. I mentioned Absalom Jones. Absalom Jones was right there with Richard Allen with the founding of the Free African Society, and with those folk being dragged out of St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church. Now, there's a split within the Free African Society in the wake of people leaving St. George's. And Absalom Jones leads a group, and they join in with the Episcopalian Church, well, the Protestant Episcopal Church in Philadelphia. And eventually, those folk are going to found their own church, the African Protestant Episcopal Church. And Absalom Jones is going to be the first Black priest ordained as a Protestant Episcopal. So this is happening, and this is happening first decade of the 19th century.
All right. So the Episcopals come eventually get there, but they're a little late.
Yes. But same context with the founding of the African Methodist Church. In fact, St. Thomas, well, it's called St. Thomas now, but the African Church, even though it wasn't an independent church because of the structure of Anglicanism or Episcopalianism, but nevertheless, it was a Black church through and through with Black leadership, but it was his own church before Allen founded Bethel.
So we've been talking about churches and denominations founding in the North. I'm wondering what this looked like in the South.
South is interesting. As I mentioned before, there's independent Baptist churches that some historians date beginning in the 1750s. Now, there's debate about that. But definitely in the 1770s, we begin to see independent Black Baptist churches in Virginia. Also in the 1770s, we get an independent church in Aiken County, South Carolina, that's deemed the oldest continuous Black Baptist congregation. It's no longer in South Carolina. It's actually the church moved across the Savannah River and went into Georgia, but it's still in existence. Yeah. And then very early in the 19th century, in Savannah, Georgia, you get First African that was a plantation church, still in existence today. So you have really old Black churches in Savannah, like three of them that actually came out, or two of them came out of First African, right? So these are early 19th century independent churches, always were independent churches.
So these are continuous churches. You're saying they're the oldest continuous Black churches in America, and they're still Black churches, and they're still vibrant congregations.
Yeah.
And one can visit them today.
You go to Savannah, Georgia, you can visit First African Baptist Church. Now, the Methodists, they had a foothold. Well, the AME Church, put it this way. The AME Church had a foothold in Charleston, South Carolina, and in the early part of the 19th century. But with the Denmark Vesey conspiracy that occurred in South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina, that was in 1823. It was a potential revolt. Denmark Vesey had won his freedom by hitting the lottery. And he was kind of ashamed, not in a bad sense, but ashamed that this favor came upon him and not anybody else. But still, as a free Black man, he still had ties to the slave community, and he was planning a slave revolt in Charleston. And a lot of the organizing was through the AME Church there. So Weiss got wind of it and squelched the revolt, and with that, banned the African Methodist Episcopal Church from being in South Carolina. And that ban stayed into effect until slavery ends in South Carolina.
Do we have a record of the debates or any writings that come out of that congregation? What was going on in theologically in people's minds? Do we know that?
Yeah, we do. There is a book by Douglas Egerton, E-G-E-R-T-O-N. He's written probably the best book out on the Denmark VC case and the Denmark VC revolt. I mean, Denmark VC is cast into the broader context of the type of thinking that David Walker had, who was actually from Charleston but had moved to Boston, and he wrote his famous appeal in Boston, in which he argued for abolition within a Christian framework. And he wasn't the first. You go back to the American Revolutionary period, and you have enslaved people writing petitions in New England, basing their freedom upon Christian principles. So,
but here the difference is they would take that argument to the extent of saying if the white community is not going to give it to us, we're going to take it violently if necessary. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
From what I understand, there were different views espoused within the African American Christian community about the ways that abolition should be achieved. Is that correct?
More or less. I think when we're talking about abolitionism, especially Black abolitionism, there's some nuance. There were debates regarding whether or not Black folks should even stay in the country, that they should pack up and move to the Caribbean or to Africa. All that was part of the broad stroke of abolitionism. But I think of the Black Presbyterian, Henry Highland Garnett, who was just on the same level, I would say, as Frederick Douglass, and those two actually had a controversy with each other. Garnett proposed uprising in his speech that he gave in Buffalo, New York in 1843, where he argued that enslaved persons in the South should not simply capitulate to their condition, and that if they needed to get their freedom through violent means. And that wasn't all that he argued, but for him, that was like a last resort. Shouldn't just lay down and accept being enslaved, especially whole unjust system.
Earlier in the show, when you mentioned plantation churches, and yes. I'm wondering if you can tell us what those are.
Yeah, back as early as we know in the 1770s, and this would be during the Revolutionary era, during the late First Great Awakening, where you had itinerant preachers, especially Baptists, going into the rural Southland, and they're preaching to slaves on plantations. And I mean, that's how the Silver Bluff Church was founded. A white pastor had come, a preacher had come and preached to slaves, and those slaves were converted, and eight of them were all baptized, and they became a church. And so that happened in South Carolina, happened in nearby Georgia as well. Yeah, I mean, that was a result of some revival, late Great Awakening preaching. But there's also, going into the early part of the 19th century, like 1820s, 1830s, there was also a concerted effort to have plantation missions, which is a little bit different than what happened in the late Great Awakening period. So Presbyterians, for example, took the lead on that down south. A Presbyterian minister by the name of Charles Colcock Jones. He had this elaborate scheme of sending missionaries to plantations to try to convert enslaved people. But the thing with this scheme was that it really was serving the master class, in that Charles Colcock Jones and other Presbyterians who were behind this had to ensure the planter class that we're not going to present Christianity in a way that will excite revolt. In fact, we're going to preach slaves obey your master in the Lord, for this is right. So their mission was a way to, again, appease the master class, but also an attempt to subdue the slave class. And it fizzled. It didn't have great success.
So let me think. Thinking about it from the other end, is there any evidence that in some of these revivals, some slaves became Christians because they imagined that they would be better treated by their Christian masters?
That did happen. and people did think like that.
I'm not trying to paint a broad brush. I'm just trying to understand human motivation. One of the questions I keep asking myself is, why did an enslaved group adopt the religion of their masters that was characterized by just this vicious oppression?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming some of it had to do with a genuine spiritual encounter with Christ. I'm assuming most of that.
Yeah.
But given human nature, I'm assuming that there's mixed motives as well going on once in a while.
Yeah, definitely. I think the other motivation was that this could be a route to freedom. But yeah, and this would have been more the case a little bit prior. Like in the 17th century, there was this belief that a baptized slave had a right to his or her freedom. And that led to legislation in Maryland and in Virginia and in Jamaica to say baptism does not change the social and civil condition of an enslaved person. So if you were a slave before baptism, you remain a slave after baptism. So even that kind of thinking had pretty much, well, I'm not going to say pretty much died out by the time we get to the First Great Awakening, because there's actually an interesting segment in Alaudé Equiano's autobiography. Alaudé Equiano was born in Africa, so he claims that there's a lot of debate about that, but I'm not going to get into that. But he wrote his interesting narrative in 1789, and in that section, he talks about his baptism that occurred in the Anglican Church in England. And a few years down the line, his master, who is a British Royal Navy officer, a lieutenant, sells him out of the blue. And Equiano protests and says, you can't sell me because I've been baptized and I have a right basically to refuse sale. Well, that wasn't true. That wasn't true legally, because almost 100 years before that, it had been specified that if you're a baptized slave, you don't have any rights like that. So, yeah, I would definitely argue that these folks who are being converted in First Great Awakening and afterwards, I mean, they're Christians, but also I think they're looking toward freedom. But I don't think they're confused about whether or not they're going to get better treatment from slave owners.
They're not naive about that.
No.
Okay.
No.
But in one sense, they did experience, at least the reading of the accounts that I've done, they did experience a tremendous psychological and spiritual freedom from the result of their conversion and participating in worship services. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's fair. It's fair. I wouldn't want to stretch that too much.
Yeah, not to say it made everything okay.
Right.
But the psychological oppression of slavery must be enormous. And to hear the gospel preached and the hope of the kingdom of heaven must have just been an extraordinary blessing to a lot.
Without a doubt.
So the question I want to conclude with is, what type of effect has African-American Christianity had on white Christianity? Or in other words, how has the theology and orthopraxy of the African-American church affected the white church?
That's a difficult question.
You've got 1 minute. No, I'm just kidding.
it's difficult in the sense that it is difficult to quantify that phenomenon. I would say anecdotally that, especially coming out of the civil rights movement, that white churches, and especially I would say white churches who we would call white liberal churches, they've been more accepting of the type of theology that has come out of black church, especially from that era onward. So speaking out against injustice, being civically engaged, speaking truth, that sort of thing. In some cases, we'll call more evangelical churches have, but there's still a lot of work to do. What the black church does is that it shows that it could be conservative. A church can be conservative theologically, but also be more active in terms of social engagement.
Yeah, I think that's the very lesson the evangelical church is learning as we speak. Our assumption has been, because of the modernist fundamentalist controversy, that to be involved in social justice means that your theology has gone liberal. And the black church stands as a great contradiction to that assumption. I think it's often true in the white, that has often been true in the white church. That's just a fact of the matter. But it's the African-American church stands as a witness to saying, no, it doesn't have to be that way.
That's true.
Well, thank you for all this really amazing history. As a reminder, You can help support this podcast by subscribing to CT Magazine. And one of the benefits of having the subscription to CT Magazine is being able to read all of our Christian history archives, which do have some information that you've heard here and some more information. I've been reading a lot this week, for instance, about the holiness movement and the Pentecostal church and the way that the Black church was really influential in that. So anyway, there's a lot of really good information in there. And we have set up a special page that will allow you to get a discounted subscription plus a bonus download our podcast team put together. And you can get that deal at orderct.com/quicktolisten. It's orderct.com/quicktolisten. I just have one other announcement too, and that's if you are a pastor or work for a church, we could use your help. Our sister brand, Church Law and Tax, is conducting a national church compensation survey right now, and they need as many survey responses as possible. So by participating, you'll be publishing fair standards for pastors and church workers. This will give churches and people in ministry the opportunity to see fair standards for pay and benefits. And if you go ahead and participate in this, they will give you a choice of incentives for completing the survey. So if you're interested in doing that, you can go to cltsurvey.com/2017. It's cltsurvey.com/2017. Now is the time of the show we call Precious Moments, where all of you listeners get to know us a little bit better. It's also the time where people can share what they found on the internet and something that is bringing them joy this week. Eric, are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right. So what's bringing you joy?
In men's Bible study in my church, we're going through 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and we just finished the last chapter in 1st Thessalonians, where we are commanded to rejoice always.
Awesome. Are you on the internet somewhere where people can find you?
I do have a Twitter handle, basically my name, Eric M. Washington, M as in Michael. Also, my alternative Twitter handle is @BlackPuritan.
Tell us about that Twitter handle.
Well, I mean, I've been on Twitter for a while, and one of my favorite historical figures is Lemuel Haynes, who was known as a Black Puritan.
All right, Mark.
My moment of joy was Monday morning when I opened the back door and I welcomed Andy Olson into the building. Andy is our new print managing editor. And after a season of a few months in which we've been without a print managing editor, in which the load for putting out 3 or 4 print issues has rested on the shoulders of people who already had a load on their shoulders, including myself, it was a great moment of joy to recognize that that transitional period was over and that Andy was going to come and join us.
I noticed he wasted very little time in like giving you a hard time. Did you get that sense too? And pretty much all of us. I apologized to him yesterday for neglecting to like invite him out with myself and one of our coworkers, since I know he's here without his family. And he was like, I can't believe that you didn't do that. Well, Mark, are you available for people to follow online?
Yes, through something called the Galley Report that you can subscribe to by going to ChristianityToday.com/TheGalleyReport. It's a weekly set of links and commentary of stuff I find really interesting. And I think the people who follow me find it interesting, although they wouldn't follow me on that. So I encourage you to do that.
My precious moment this week is a movie, which is shocking. Everyone, I know I went to the movies. I barely go to the movies. I saw the movie La La Land on Sunday. I really appreciated the music in it. I just generally find myself having this music, like whenever I watch a musical, it's like stuck in my head for the next week. And I've also been listening to the soundtrack nonstop. But I appreciated some of the deeper themes that it had about kind of like the crossroads of relationships and also vocation and what you feel called to do and how sometimes those intersect and sometimes they do not. And I think it raises some important questions about that in kind of a lighthearted and beautiful way. I am available, followed on Twitter at MEPAYNL. You are warned, baseball season kind of started today, so I will resume tweeting about baseball like I like to do all the time, as those of you who already follow me know. All right, well, that is it for us this week. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Quick to Listen. This podcast is a production of Christianity Today. You can find our other podcasts by searching iTunes for Christianity Today. Remember to head to orderct.com/quicktolisten to subscribe for our lowest price. Thank you to our producers, Richard Clark and Cray Allred. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes and SoundCloud. And if you like the show, make sure to rate and review us on iTunes. That really helps a lot. We will see you all next week.